still morning. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram for the Earl Ingram Show. And you can call in. Sam has the call-in information.
Give us a call or text. Excuse me. Give us a call or text here at 101 FM The Shaw or WAUK 540 AM. And it is 844-967-2789 to join that conversation.
So, Sam, before the break, I think we were talking about student loans, and I was sort of crying out about how it is that our politicians could ignore the problems of families and otherwise focus all their attention, for instance, on spending money on the military. But I think that that news flash there showed us just how distracted our political processes can be, because I think a good 2 minutes of that news forecast was about the Gableman investigation, about a supposedly fraudulent campaign and election process that occurred now just a year and a half ago. That elected the sitting president, and which has so far, I think, turned up absolutely nothing. So,
let's just keep throwing some tax dollars at it. It's fine. Let's just keep funding it anyway. It's fine.
No, let's fund it, and let's spend our time, our airtime, and our valuable legislative time talking about it, because then we aren't going to talk about things like, how do we set up a system in our society, a governmental process, which supports the people in this country rather than the way it's currently jiggered? And I would suggest that a lot of this has to do with the problem Tom from Los Angeles always identifies, which is money in politics. It seems that in order to get elected in this country, you need to line up the proper interest groups. And you also have to line up sufficient money. And both of those don't tend to relate directly to the problems in this country. The most active interest groups, well, let's identify what's probably the most effective lobby in the country. Isn't it gun rights? I think the NRA is identified as one of the strongest lobby groups in this country. And then another interest group, which I don't diminish the extent of the emotional relationship of this interest to the people's interest, but the abortion issue has drawn more political attention and is probably one of the strongest litmus. So in this country, if you want to run for office from the right, there's two positions that you need to embrace absolutely. One of them is right to life, and the other one is gun rights. What do those two policies have to do? I mean, I realize the right to life people would say that they're worried about future generations, the ones that don't even exist yet. But what do they have to do with the rights of even that generation once they come into existence? And to me, it seems to me that our political process has been focused so much, for instance, on this abortion issue. It's focused on generations that haven't been conceived yet and ignores the interests of all of those generations that have been conceived, the most important one being the children that are recently born, those recently born children whose parents don't have maternity leave, who don't have child daycare set up for them, who don't have preschool education available to them, who won't have health care available to them unless they either are sufficiently poor so that they qualify for Medicaid, or if their parents are sufficiently affluent and entrenched into the middle class so that they can afford health care insurance. They're going to find themselves without all of those things. These children who are going to be born into a country that ranks 38th in the world in child poverty and ranks well up and not at the top, and not best, but rather well down the line on infant mortality. Why are we not so very worried about children once they come into existence, but we're going to spend all of our political attention on the children not yet born?
Thank you for saying that, Sandy, because as a young woman, I cannot imagine, as the text earlier said, those prices of giving birth alone, I could not afford, even if I wanted a child, I could not afford giving birth. I could not afford supplying any good life for that child. I can barely do that for myself right now. And you're telling me that if I get pregnant, I'll just add the child to foster care? And look how successful that system's going for us and how many problems that is causing for the youth growing up in America. Like, I don't understand what the plan is.
And let's just compare that to what would happen to you if you were living in France or Germany or one of the developed countries in Europe. In that circumstance, you could choose reasonably between a woman who becomes pregnant, maybe in a manner that's unplanned. She could rationally choose between having the child, because the government is going to, she is going to have provided for her, and her child is going to have provided for it. Let's look at the child's interest, the health care required for a safe birth. They're going to experience a lower infant mortality rate than is experienced in the United States. That child will be born into a better child poverty circumstance than would be the average case in the United States. That child will be born into a family that has maternity leave so that the parents can be available to the child during the most immediate formative months of their life. That child will have child daycare available to them because it will be provided to them. And that child will be educated in a manner that is fair and equal to the education available to everyone else. So the decision made by that parent is far less difficult, far less of a rock in a hard spot than the decision you just described that you would have to make if this same circumstance happened to you. Why have we gotten there politically in this country? Can you figure that out, Sam?
I would love to know, because I, as a 23-year-old woman, never thought that I would be put in this position that I could, am potentially going to be put in this next couple months. Genuinely, I am horrified. I am appalled. I am a toaster oven, apparently. All I am is a toaster oven that produces new beings. So, you know, what do I have to say about my body? It's fine. But on the other hand, we can have people on the more conservative side of the spectrum say, oh, my body, my choice for masks or vaccines. But when I say it about something that my body will literally be changed forever for, it's not okay.
Well, you know, and the thing of it is that the focus seems to be on the fetus and on the viability of the fetus and the infant. The focus seems to be eliminated immediately after exit from the womb and the child is birthed, and then what happens to the welfare of that child. And why are we not so focused on that particular circumstance politically? You would think that religious values, personal values, family values would focus all of our political attention on what happens to this child when it emerges from the womb and enters our world where we actually have control of it. Instead of that, all of this political interest and focus, and now the Supreme Court's focus, seems to be focused on the fetus when the only sustenance that is provided to that fetus is from the mother being required to carry it through to birth. And then what happens after birth? What happens to the mother? What happens to the mother's obligations to the child? And what happens to that child? And we seem to turn our back on that. And particularly the conservatives, who seem to carry closest to their heart and minds and the notion of the right of the fetus to be born, seem to ignore the interest of that child post-birth. And to me, I have such a great deal of trouble understanding that point. I can understand the heat and fire and emotion over the issue of abortion. I don't agree with those who oppose the choice, but I understand it. But I don't understand turning our back on families and children post-birth and what we are doing to each of our next generations when the obligation I thought that our parents handed us was to be better stewards of the and to provide to our offspring a better opportunity than we realized, to give the world to them better off than we received it. And what's happening now is exactly the inverse in the United States. Generation after generation now, ever since the baby boomers were, I think, the last generation to have things better than their parents. And the boomers have managed to hand to their children and to their grandchildren a world that is less capable of providing for them the opportunities which we had. And to me, this is a sin. This is a terrible political sin. And I cry out to the political processes to start to focus on things this basic. Why don't we get down to basics in our conversation about things instead of talking about things in sound bites, which have an inability to relate back to Tom, Dick, and Mary? Because, you know, so many families in this country are living paycheck to paycheck. And why don't we just deal with the people who live? Many people live paycheck to paycheck who have incomes like I just described. There's very little sympathy being extended to families with $100,000 a year of income. But you know what? In the environment, in the economy that we've created, those families are living a fearful existence paycheck to paycheck. And if our political process, and particularly if the Democratic Party doesn't figure out how to reach out to those people, we are going to find a problem with who we can elect to office and who we do elect to office. And I would assert that part of our issue with respect to how state houses are controlled and what portions of our geography are red and what portions are blue can be laid at the feet of the inability of the political process to focus on what I'm describing right now, which are fundamental family issues, and family issues which are shared by many people with incomes that far exceed the poverty level within cities. And if we do that, we can stop worrying about gerrymandered maps, because blue will extend into the rural communities and we'll find ourselves with a far different political dynamic. I think we're headed to another break. We'll be back shortly. Show Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram. We've been talking about a variety of issues. We've begun to focus on sort of the problems associated with student loans and the economic problems faced by almost all the families in America. At the break, I think I was doing some math. I'm sort of a math guy, and when you get down to measuring numbers in terms of incomes and expenses, you realize the substantial number of families in America that are behind the eight ball, and it's the question of wealth accumulation and the question of how well the stock market are doing is so irrelevant to so many people in this country. And even though we've had a real wage increase for the last 12 months, we now have coming at us a period of inflation. And if you live paycheck to paycheck, you immediately realize the extent to which you will face problems with just modest increases in costs. If you've barely been making it month to month with what you earn, then it becomes far harder to absorb a cost increase just at the grocery store, or at the grocery store and the gas pump, or at the grocery store, the gas pump, and with your utility bills. And all three of those things promise to go up very substantially in the next while. And that substantial increase is going to be very hard to bear for a lot of families. And it's a lot of families who have an income level higher than most of us would expect. Because as I was saying before, I think most families who are earning $100,000 a year, or maybe more than $100,000 a year, are living still paycheck to paycheck. I mean, if you're earning $60,000 a year, it's hard to feel sorry for someone who's earning $100,000. Until you realize that probably all they've done with that added money is move into a home that's different, possibly more comfortable than yours, but it's absorbing all of the dollar difference that exists in your incomes. And is our political process, are we paying adequate attention to this widespread problem in our society of paycheck to paycheck living? And does it exist in other economies around the world? And if it doesn't, why doesn't it? And again, I come back to the social safety net issue. It's so clear that our inability to develop a value system that is related to the rights of our children is driving us in the direction of where we are at today politically, which is putting everyone into this kind of laissez-faire, you know, do as you can, pay for everything you need and get. You can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I mean, I don't know what the standard philosophy is that got us here, but the American system, our cultural value system, has taken us to the point of putting everyone, almost everyone in this society, in a dangerous and fearful position. And fearfulness drives us to very high emotions. And I would assert that that fearfulness that so many people exist with day to day is what's driving us into this polarized political environment. And so, again, I would lay at the feet of our lack of a social safety net the polarization and anger which exists between people in this country because so many people are fearful. You can say, well, we're fearful of our status, that the white America is fearful of losing its majority status. And I would assert that a big part of that fearfulness is driven by the fact that they are more fearful day to day and month to month, every 2 weeks when that paycheck comes and it gets totally consumed by their expenses, that fear is reignited in them and they become angry at their circumstance, fearful at the position they're put in, and who should they be angry with? And, you know, one of the only focuses for anger that everyone has is either the people that are different than them or the government that seems to be not serving them. And a big part of our political movement of maybe some of the most angry population is the people who have landed on the right, who have landed on the right because they're angry with their government. I would assert that many of them are angry with the government because of their paycheck to paycheck existence. And they're worried about their status, and that manifests itself by being worried about immigrants, by being worried about the urban problems that seem to be getting the focus rather than the focus that is being aimed at their problem in particular. So why have we not been able to move away from asserting that it's progressives, people who on the right would assert are radicals, progressives like Bernie Sanders, to talk about a social safety net as if it's something that's achievable? The progressives, the people who even centrist Democrats would assert are radical, point at the social safety net that exists around the world in almost every other developed country as evidence that we could and should have it here in America. And they assert that that's a pipe dream because it's a radical concept. And I would simply assert that while I'm a centrist, I think it's now become a radical concept to reject that principle and that concept of a social safety net. It is going to become radical to reject that because rejecting it is going to leave us with an entirely untenable socioeconomic position in our country. It's driving us into a wealth accumulation that puts in jeopardy the safety and welfare of many, many families. Should you have to accumulate a massive nest egg in order to afford your children the opportunities that they need to have in order to participate in the economy? Well, in the American system, yes, we do. We need to have a nest egg because we need to be able to save for all of these expenditures, massive expenditures, when you measure them against incomes that are required for healthcare, that are required for child daycare, that are required for education, and are required for retirement. It becomes, those four necessities become the focus of almost every family's full economic preoccupation. And if they are unfulfilled, they drive one into a fearful position. And that fearfulness is separating our society in a terribly divisive way. And it's also removing the opportunity from our incoming generations to participate in the economy. And what's going to happen is that all these other economies who have had a much more enlightened approach to how they handle the birthright of their children are going to stride right past America because they will be in a position to be nimble in the face of technological change. They will have an economy filled with trained people, educated people, people capable of moving to the next job. Why do we think China has had such an effective growth coming out of third world to first world, bursting on the scene? Well, they've had it because they have an education system that is equitable amongst their population. They have a broadly educated population. They provide health care to their population. They don't have a nest egg requirement in order to burst onto the scene into America. Now, many entrenched Americans, fourth and fifth generation Americans, will say, well, I was able to do it. Why can't they? And then they point at the incoming immigrant cohort and they say, they're able to do it. Why can't everyone do it? Well, the incoming immigrant cohort start out at the low level on the economy, where they probably are having health care provided to them, assisted by the government. But those people are dedicated and have come here solely for the purpose of pushing their children's birthright ahead of them. And they have sacrificed everything. They have moved from their place from which they're comfortable. They've moved to this country. They take any and all jobs necessary to push their children ahead. And yes, they do succeed, but it's that great sacrifice. And are we going to require that great sacrifice of every entrenched American as well? Well, it seems that it's not working very well. I think we, again, have another break. And so we'll be back shortly. The Earl Ingram Show, Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram. We've been talking about a variety of issues, focusing primarily on the ones that are faced by families throughout the country and the extent to which some of the issues that are on the hot stove today, like student loans, are just all a part of the same problem. I think we have a caller calling in. Who do we have? Sam, do we have a caller?
Yes, we have Earl joining us right now.
Well, that's what I heard. He sent me a text and he said, should he call? I said, absolutely.
Yes, it's good to hear your voice, Earl. How you doing?
As I always say, things don't always go according to plan, but how do you handle things when they don't go according to plan? And it's great to have friends like Sandy around who can, at the last minute, fill in for you. Thank you, Sandy. How you doing?
Well, my voice box is getting a little tired, but other than that, no, it's been good. I think we've had a bunch of issues to talk about, and I'm sort of ready to find a candidate who wants to fly with all of these ideas, but it's going all right.
Well, I had some things I wanted to talk about early on, but if you've been talking about some things, let's go ahead with those.
No. Let's hear what you've had to say. I'm always ready for something new.
So, unnamed senior American officials revealed to the New York Times that the U.S. has provided intelligence that helped Ukrainians target many of the Russian generals killed during the Putin invasion. Now, Sandy, I would say that if I'm on the other end of that, and I'm Russia, and I'm hearing that, and that can be corroborated, that we've lost generals because America has shown Ukraine how to target that. I don't know. I'm not going to be too forgiving to America for that.
It's interesting. Lots of these intelligence leaks seem to be generated by America trying to point out all the ways in which we've provided various kinds of technical support, intelligence support to Ukraine. You know, if you're doing it secretly, I don't quite understand why we decide that we need to do it publicly. But, these kind of leaks don't happen accidentally. And I'm confident that these leaks were generated because the administration wanted to have this kind of publicity. But it can't be helpful in terms of this notion that the United States is trying to walk a tightrope and trying to provide aid to Ukraine without precipitating a direct conflict with Russia. And then we keep identifying the ways in which we've upped the ante with respect to the kinds of support we provide to Ukraine. Now, maybe we're doing it because we know that Russia has intelligence apparatus that permits them to understand exactly what we're doing anyway, so why not talk about it publicly? And that's probably the case. But there's no question that this tightrope we're walking is beginning to vibrate. You know, I picture like these Italian tightrope walkers who strung a tightrope up across the Grand Canyon and then started walking, and then it gets, they get out in the middle and it begins to waggle kind of dangerously. And I suspect that's what's happening to the tightrope we're walking now with respect to the aid we're providing and the dangers we're creating of a more direct confrontation. Well, you know, one of the other things that our intelligence has talked about, however, is the fact that Russia so far has exercised far more moderation in the nature of the military campaign that they've embarked on in Ukraine as compared to what they could have embarked on. And we attribute it to a variety of factors. I was reading an interview with an anonymous general who was saying that, you know, it could be because of incompetence of the Russian military, it could be because of the incompetence of their planning, or it could be purposeful because maybe they in fact are not as brutish and as malicious as we've otherwise characterized them, and they're trying to save the infrastructure of Ukraine to the extent possible so that it isn't ultimately destroyed by this campaign that they're waging. And, you know, to me, the most sensible is maybe the last one in terms of what's happening, although it is clear that some of the things that have been uncovered in this campaign have revealed the softness of the military of Russia in terms of their capacity to wage war of this nature based on their training and the maintenance of their equipment. But in any case, we are walking a tightrope, and the question is, How much are we willing, how many kind of seismic vibrations are we willing to set up in that tightrope with respect to how we're willing to arm Ukraine? I was identifying on the show before you got on, my biggest fear of what we're doing is that it's going to reinvigorate military expenditures to the point where we're going to not have a $785 billion military budget, but when we get done with hardening the world and creating a Cold War that involves partitioning Russia and probably China, you know, we'll be spending well over $1 trillion a year. And what policies will that rob the American people of? What support will that rob the American people of? And why are we making these choices? You know, it's terrifying.
You know, Sandy, this was in the Hill today. It says U.S. has helped Ukraine target Russian generals as a report. And as you stated, why would that be out there and in the stratosphere for Russia? If it's here and everybody else can get it, surely Russia can get it. And so why would that be out there in the public?
Well, yeah, you know, that's what I was saying. Why are we deciding to do it? I think we're doing it for internal political purposes, trying to demonstrate to the American people, the ones who are beating the drum for us to do more and provide ever more support to the Ukrainians so that we can, in this sort of NFL Sunday game kind of mystique that the American people have, why we can't, like, you know, win this contest with Russia by providing more support with Ukraine, when the American people aren't really asking themselves the serious question of what contest is it we're trying to win, and why is it that we're trying to weaken Russia, and what is the long-term implication of it? And to me, the long-term implications of this whole conflict are very, very troublesome.
You know, Sandy, at the same time, this is another article that I was going to be spending some time talking about. And there are people, should the U.S. embrace its role as the world's armory against aggression? And yes, there are people who are having this discussion, and yes, they believe that we need to do exactly what you just got through saying. So while all of this is going on, there are people who are plotting and planning to do just what you just said. Increase all of those things, and we should be, continue to be control of what happens globally and militarily. And you know, you're thinking about all these other things, because I was also going to talk with you and say you are 100% correct that all of what was going on in the last year and a half, that we were going to wind up in recession. And you also predicted that the interest rates were going to rise. You also predicted that inflation was going to happen. And all of those things are going on at the same time. We've got these people talking about we need to increase our presence globally and militarily. And I don't know if the people, the American people, Sandy, can handle all those things at once.
Well, not only can't the American people handle it, but the American government can't. You know, the interesting thing I think I talked about on a prior show, when the USSR collapsed, the United States immediately shifted gears from a Cold War to talking about Pax Americana, in which America was going to become sort of this, what you described, this global policeman, who were going to make sure that democracy reigned throughout the world. We would use our military might to bring good and justice to the world. It was kind of a way to justify having a huge military budget, defense budget, at a time when there was no apparent enemy out there to be worried about, because China had not yet risen to the point of being such a dominant player in the world. Russia had kind of collapsed, imploded. And so why did we need a big military? Well, we needed it to bring peace to the world and to spread democracy. And now we're talking about that again, but now we're talking about implementing it as the peacekeeper. The UN doesn't do it. Apparently, the United States does. The UN can't decide where and how to deploy military peacekeepers around the world, but the United States unilaterally can. And, of course, we, the American people, don't have much to say about how and where we do that. We simply get our marching orders from the government when they tell us what they're going to do and how we're what we need to support in order to be patriots. And what does that mean for us? We're now creating a new Cold War environment, or we're participating in the creation of a new Cold War environment, which is going to be terribly expensive in terms of military budget. The Biden administration is already talking about a $50 billion increase, and who knows what it'll be in fact. And this at a time when we don't have adequate health care, and we need to spend money on health care, when we've got $1.6 trillion of student loans, and we're talking about forgiving student loans, that's a ginormous bill if we do that. When we have a system where we don't have a safety net that should be employed or should be deployed and is deployed in every other developed country, and we don't have it. And I think the only reason we can justify not having it is because we have a huge defense budget. And in fact, I traveled in Europe with a good friend who's a conservative, who, when we were traveling in Norway, and we were telling ourselves what a beautiful infrastructure they had. And he said, well, of course they do, because they don't spend the money on defense that we do. He was saying it pejoratively, like if these people just simply spend as much as they should on defense, they wouldn't have all this good stuff. But maybe you can look at the flip side of that and say, well, if we didn't spend this much on defense, we could have all that good stuff, and we don't.
You know, Sandy, this was President Roosevelt in 1940. In December 1940, 16 months into World War II, and 1 year before the U.S. became a combatant, Roosevelt told Americans that to avoid military engagement while protecting national interests, the United States needed to support the nations defending themselves against attack by the Axis. Oh, we got to go to break. Yeah. All right. Okay, listen, we got to go to break. We'll do this when we come back. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Sandy Williams is filling in for me. We'll be right back. It's good getting used. Oh, you just keep on using me until you use me up. And
till you use me up.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. I want to thank Sandy Williams for filling in for me and doing a more than admirable job. You know, Sandy, before we went to break, this is a paragraph that I must read because it coincides with what we were just talking about. And this was former President Franklin Delano Roosevelt 40 years ago, and he had this to say. In December 1940, 16 months into World War II and 1 year before the U.S. became a combatant, Roosevelt told Americans that to avoid military engagement while protecting national interests, the United States needed to support the nations defending themselves against attack by the Axis. He continued, referring primarily to Britain, the people of Europe who are defending themselves do not ask us to do their fighting. They asked us for the implements of war, the planes, the tanks, the guns, the freighters, which will enable them to fight for their liberty and our security. He insisted America must be the great arsenal of democracy. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show if we were at war. That's where we are now, Sandy. And so why should we be that? And how can we afford to be that? And so the American people suffer for that reason?
Well, you know, the circumstances were quite different. I mean, I know there are people trying to compare the Russian campaign in Ukraine to the initial campaigns of Hitler and suggesting that it's just the beginning of the same kind of danger. But what was going on in Europe and the invasion of, for instance, initially Czechoslovakia, then Poland, were really far different. And they were not... Germany taking countries or doing war with countries where there was the same kind of circumstance. It was really just Germany reaching out to take land which they wanted. There was the Alsace-Lorraine in France that they coveted. There was the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. There was Poland, and it was just open aggression and extremely ambitious aggression. And the United States was coming out of isolationism at that point. We had almost no standing army. We had very little in the way of munitions to provide. And we had a depression that we were climbing out of. And we reawakened our economy in many respects by building up our munitions capability and the Lend-Lease program, which we entered into to send equipment to the European combatants. And it was really in lieu of America sending troops there, which ultimately we ended up doing because of the Pearl Harbor invasion and Hitler unilaterally declaring war without invading us because I guess he expected us to enter the war anyway. I think it was a very different circumstance. And I think that we've taken the military-industrial complex to the point where we've maintained readiness to be a participant in something like World War II for that Roosevelt statement was 82 years ago, and we've maintained that readiness for war at a World War II level for the last 72 years since 1950, and it's taken an enormous toll in the American economy, and it's shifted our societal values a great deal, and it's created an interest group which Dwight Eisenhower described as the military-industrial complex, which has had great sway over how our tax dollars are spent, and it's a very big social worry. I would suggest that the reason we don't have, or one of the reasons we don't have, the kind of social safety net that supports vibrant economies in Europe, is because we have had such a huge defense budget that has incapacitated us from considering these other programs that are designed and aim much more at the American people.
So, Sandy, how do you then, from your perspective, knowing we're going into recession, as you predicted, projected, we're headed towards recession, interest rates climbing, inflation, which is going to cut down resources for the American people, and then an increase in military spending. How does all that balance out?
Well, it balances out. You know, it doesn't. It suggests really that there'll be increasing deficits going forward. You know, during recessions, you run deficits as the way to support an economy and to try and keep the recession from getting too deep. That was why I said it was such a sin for the Trump administration to have tax cuts, which not only created immediate deficits during a time of boom, but which assured that during a time of recession, we would have even bigger deficits because the tax revenues would go down with the reduction in GDP or the reduction in the growth of GDP. And so, you know, it portends bad things. It creates bigger deficits going forward, higher interest rates, will require much greater commitment of tax dollars to servicing our debt, which the much greater cost of servicing debt will further increase deficits. So we're creating a deficit spiral that is going to be troublesome. And you know, whereas Keynesians have always said a big GDP can support a big ongoing deficit and a big national debt, we've never tested the boundary of that. And I fear that what we've created with the Trump tax decrease and now with the inevitable recession and with a wartime economy, we've created set the table for some very substantial problems.
You know, Sandy, from just, the last several years and the talk about the great economy and all those things, and then the twinkling of an eye, the bottom is falling out. And the pain that people are going to be feeling, this is not something, once again, that's going to be, you know, you snap your finger and it's over. The pain that people are going to be suffering is going to be for a long time to come. And you know, some people, I don't know how they're going to be able to manage to pull through it. The safety net that you always talked about, which should be in place for times like these, is not there. It's not strong enough. And so we're headed for some hard times.
Well, I think that what's happening in the country is we're setting the table for a hard time societally. You know, we can talk about people suffering economically and in recessions, and we can talk about the sort of the bitter pill of that. But when things get too divisive, when things get too unsustainable, when people are between too tough a rock and a hard spot, it turns into a societal problem and a socioeconomic problem that could be a bombshell. And I just think that the American system is stressing itself unduly by the circumstance that we're creating here. And by stepping into much bigger defense expenditures, we're just going to create a much tighter and more difficult problem. We ought to have our eyes open, and we ought to be talking about this with much greater clarity and with much more care. And Earl, you do a good job of uncovering these things.
Well, you know, Sandy, tomorrow, we'll be back together and we'll spend more time talking about this because, you know, I mean, many of the American people aren't aware of this. And as you always say, those who can afford it won't hurt so much, but they're less and less of us who can. Thank everybody who made the show go. Sandy, thank you for stepping in and doing a great job. You and I will be back together again on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Be back tomorrow. Thank you, Sam. See you later.
Yep. See you.